It's taken far too long, but I've come to the realization that I prefer playing games on original hardware rather than under emulation, with one exception.
I think I know what the exception is. So this is obviously old games from the past you're referring to here.
Yes, I have been gaming since the 1970s, when the first game I remember playing electronically was a tennis, badminton, or like squash kind of TV game where it's bright orange coloured and there's two paddles and you play two player. And me and my brother and sister would, I would like to say take turns and share, but fight over is probably more accurate, the TV. And then I went through all the 8-bit consoles and had loads of other devices for playing games, like plugged into the TV, mostly in the lounge. But eventually, when I got a bit older and moved out, you know, my own devices plugged into my own television or in my own bedroom, that kind of stuff. So I've played a lot on actual hardware over the years. Yeah.
Yeah, so my first experiences of gaming on devices was also in the 70s, and it was a family member, my Uncle Les, who had an Atari something. I remember the black and wood veneer finish, and it was Pong and I think something was like volleyball, you know, and you had the little paddle with the wheel and all the rest of it. So I remember that from a very early age.
What was your first one, Mark? Was it the Xbox or Nintendo 64 or something?
Well, the first game I can remember playing, I think, is Super Mario Brothers, the original. My next-door neighbours had a NES in their living room, and we would sometimes go around there and play Super Mario Brothers there. At home, we had an Amiga 500, and the first game I can remember is we played Shadow of the Beast on the TV in the living room because the TV we had upstairs wasn't a colour TV.
Wow.
But we took over the living room one day and plugged it in there and played Shadow of the Beast. We did later get a colour TV upstairs as well, and I played quite a lot more games.
More recently, I had a Switch and a Steam Deck, and on the Steam Deck, I installed something called EmuDeck and then filled it full of legitimately obtained pieces of software that I could play using emulators. And I used to play a few of the games that I played in the past and some that I didn't play in the past. But I never really got stuck into playing the Steam Deck with EmuDeck a lot. Mm-hmm. I played with some games like once in a while, or if someone asked me what's, you know, on that machine, and I would show them an emulator and then we'd move on with our lives and not actually sit there and play it. And I find that's quite common for emulation for me personally in every time I try playing with it. Like, I'll have MAME installed and I'll play a couple of rounds of R-Type or whatever game I want to play. I've got an itch to play, but it doesn't stick and I don't play it regularly. And I think that's the same for all emulation. I don't know if it's not accurate or it's not the same or it doesn't tickle the nostalgia quite the same way as holding a device in your hand. But I've come to the realization that I prefer not emulation.
So you say holding in your hand. Is this specific to handheld devices or to also set-top box devices as well?
That's a good question. I think not. It is, I think back in the 90s, I got into buying arcade boards and I had a Super Gun, which let me play them by plugging them into the TV and plug in a Sega controller to control the arcade game. So these were like full on jammer arcade boards. And then they kind of sat around for a while, and then someone offered me a cabinet, like a full upright arcade cabinet, and I bought one, and it took up some space in the house, which was contentious. But I played with those games so much more when the boards were inside a proper upright arcade cabinet, and I had an old pub ashtray, I don't know where I got that, on the top of it, full of 10 pence pieces, and I would play it like I used to play it in the arcade. And the tension of getting to the end of a level and having to press continue and not having any credits, I didn't just press a credit button. I had to rummage around and get some 10p's. Or if I'd run out, I'd have to get the key log and open the thing if I was really getting quite far, open the drawer and grab a handful and like put them in or press the button in order to trigger a new credit. And so that experience, I find I've never replicated that sense of urgency and that tension with an emulator ever.
It's fascinating because I was going to say earlier, but my early recollections of playing games is someone in the street had, I don't know what, but it was something with Space Invaders on it. And I can remember the genuine feeling of foreboding and sweaty palms playing this game for the first time, my heart racing and breathing. It was a real experience as a young child, you know, the jeopardy of, you know, being blown up by these aliens. And I suppose that's a part of that early experience that I will never get back by replaying in any way, emulators or otherwise. But I like your story of recreating that, you know, panic of, do I have another 10 pence piece available, or has somebody pinched them off the side, which also used to happen at the cinema if you were playing.
Yeah, I kind of got a bit nostalgic because I went out for beers with a friend of mine from school a couple of weekends ago, and we started talking about some of these things. And I was thinking about when we used to go to the arcades in Aldershot. There were three arcades, I think, in Aldershot. One of them was really huge, and one of them was a bit of a dive. But he certainly rotated through games. And I remember some formative parts of my youth misspent in there and getting really sweaty and like really into the game. And then you step out into the daylight and it's like hard to see because they're all really dark inside. And I think that's why I quite like going to places like the Retro Cave that Neil runs, RMC runs, because it's also hot and sweaty in there. He does have air conditioning, but it's quite a small area and there's a bunch of humans in there.
It is a faithful reproduction of that environment, right. I have to say, yeah.
Minus the 10 pence pieces. So it got me thinking, and I realized, actually, I prefer playing on real hardware. So I went digging in the archives, my loft, and pulled out many of the devices that I've played over the years, and I set them back up again. We're filming this, and the guys can just about probably make out. Mm-hmm. Immediately behind me, there's a TV, and connected to it is a Sinclair Spectrum. And it's a real one, and there is a device attached to it. I don't load from cassette. I'm not looking for that much of an authentic experience. I could, but I have a thing called a DivMMC plugged into that, and you press a button and you can load games off of an SD card. And that's quite a pleasant experience because I could just find a game from my youth that I want to play, and I'll load it in and play it on the squishy keyboard with a terrible joystick, all that kind of stuff, on a 42-inch LCD display, which is a bit incongruous with a very low-resolution 8-bit computer, that's for sure. But I've also plugged in downstairs in the lounge three other devices. One is a Nintendo GameCube.
Now you're talking.
Yes. And that one is also modded with a Raspberry Pi Pico and a little board in the bottom, which is an interface to, guess what, an SD card, a micro SD card that contains files. And when you boot the thing up, you just pick one and it loads and it runs and you play that game.
So the GameCube, if I remember correctly, it actually had an expansion port on the bottom that you could attach a thing to play Game Boy games. Is that what this device plugs into, or is it some other connector that you've added in?
So as I recall, there are three connectors on the bottom of the GameCube.
There was a modem, a broadband adapter, and the other thing.
Expansion port. Yeah, I can't remember which one it plugs into, but it's the smallest one. I don't think it's the Ethernet one. Yeah. I think it's the smaller of the ones, and it plugs into that, this device that I purchased legitimately online and plugged an SD card into it. I think, if I recall, I had to do a little bit of soldering inside, and the Pico is behind the front bezel where the port, where the game controllers plug in. So right. It's all hidden. You can't see anything. You just turn it on, plug a controller in, and off you go. It's great fun. All you need is to plug in some memory cards to be able to save your games onto the memory cards.
So I was going to say, you know, do you think part of your enjoyment of playing on original hardware is the fact that you don't have the ability to just rifle through games really quickly? Because when you've got an emulator, if you sort of want to rage quit, it's very easy to do. But on the original things, you either had to wait a long time to load, or you had to like get up and walk over to the thing and change the cartridge. So you're probably inclined to continue playing for longer. But you don't find your speed loaders destroy that persistence of play?
Not really. I think it's more playing on the original hardware with the original controllers is part of it. Like having the GameCube controller is an amazing controller. I love it. And similarly, the WaveBird controller is a great controller. And I also have a Wii down there, which is also somewhat modded and can also do the same thing of pop a menu up. And if I want to play any of the silly dancing about the room or tennis or stuff like that, there's some real classic party games on the Wii. And I thought, well, I'll set it up. So when the family say, oh, God, you got a Wii, do you remember? And I can say, yes. And then just load that game and they can play it.
The Wii is a bit of a special case as well, because you can't really fully recreate that without the original controller. I mean, yes, you can set up an emulator and a sensor bar on a PC and use the original controller, but it's still got to be that. You can't just have any old gamepad or a keyboard and mouse and have the same experience.
Yes, and this room isn't big enough for me to stand up and jump around and have another person in here jumping around. Like, my PC is not in the lounge, and so I could do all of that, but it just wouldn't happen in my lounge because there's no PC down there.
But
I've got a little drawer underneath with four Wii controllers that I've taken the batteries out just in case, you know, they rot, and all the other, like the steering wheel adapter and the nunchucks and all that kind of stuff. And it's just nice that it's there available and it's instantly able to load, you know, so I don't have to worry about like DLC or software updates or any of that nonsense. I could just plug in. That is compelling as well, because it's the same experience. And I also have an Ouya down there. Ouya is what it says when you turn it on, which is in some ways, people would say a failed Kickstarter campaign. I wouldn't say it failed, because it got into stores and people bought it, and then later they failed. They got bought out by someone and it all disappeared. But it was a cracking little machine. It's a tiny, tiny little box that runs Android and came with some really weird controllers, but they're all right. And the reason I love that device is I have memories, really good memories, of playing some of the games on it with my kids together. Like, and some of those games were eventually ported across to Steam, and we played on a Steam computer PC as well. Like Towerfall was a really, really great multiplayer game when you're all sat in the same room. It's an amazing game. But there's a couple of weird, quirky games on there. One of them called No Brakes Valet, where you have to park cars.
I remember you showing me that when you first got it. That it blew my mind. Just the utter silliness and simplicity of it and it's brilliant fun.
It's great fun. And that's why I like that, is because I could spin up the Ouya and play that. And so I've got like these ways of playing these games. And one of them that I dug out recently was my Nintendo DS. And my Nintendo DS Lite has a card in it, which you can buy. It's called an R4 card, and other cards are available. There's one called an Ace card. There's one called a DSTT. There's loads of these different cards that you then plug an SD card in and put that in the DS and then load games, just like all the other various, you know, dodgy ways to load.
So you don't have to carry your whole library of physical cartridges, which you have around with you.
Yes, but actually, I don't even do that, because on my DS, this is the exception to the rule that I rather play on real hardware. Oh. And the exception is I emulate a Sinclair Spectrum on my DS, because there is a superb Spectrum emulator for the DS called ZXDS. Now, I did write a blog post about this. I think it was titled something like "The Best Portable Spectrum is a Nintendo DS." And that was like 4 years ago or something. And the guy still maintains the emulator, and it is fantastic. And the key point about this emulator is more a hardware decision that was made when the Nintendo DS was made. The DS Lite screen is exactly the same pixel for pixel resolution as the Sinclair Spectrum. 256 pixels across by 192 vertically. And that means it looks perfect. And the top screen is the game and the bottom screen is the keyboard and the UI and how you choose your joystick and how you load games and stuff. It's a perfect device for playing Spectrum games. And so that is my exception to the rule. And I have got a card in my DS that has basically every Spectrum game, and it is glorious and I love it. And I'll put some notes in the show notes with links to utilities and places you can get all this kind of dodgy stuff, including Vinted. I found out today I bought a second one of these R4 cards on Vinted for £7, which not bad.
After many years of Grammarly helping me correct my typing mistakes, I have finally got to ditching it. And I chose to get rid of it because it's got slow. It's another one of these things that's sort of collapsing under its own weight. It's got very expensive over the years compared to the price that I paid when I first started using it. And the most annoying feature is it wants to constantly rewrite my words, not just correct my mistakes. And this manifests in bouncing between the same corrections backwards and forwards multiple times. And I'm just like, stop doing it. Just make your mind up. Do you want it to be this or that? And so I've got increasingly frustrated with it. And last episode, I talked about my new workstations where I can run lots and lots of LLMs. And I thought to myself, this is going to be the first thing I do. Clearly, I need some LLM-backed thing to replace Grammarly, and I can do it all on my own property. So that's what I set out to go and look for. And I did my research, and I found something that is not that, that has replaced Grammarly, and it is glorious. And it is called Harper.
I feel your pain with Grammarly. I am also a subscriber of Grammarly, and it is spendy, especially when they accidentally take two payments. And which did happen to me. And I notice you very clearly said there, what, you don't need an LLM? It doesn't require an LLM? Or what? What does this do and how does it work?
Yeah, so when I was doing my research, I thought I'm going to find something that uses an LLM because LLMs do language well, right? It's in the name. So that's obviously the solution I need. And sure enough, there are plenty of them. If you go and do your research, you will find open source tools that use LLMs that do something similar to Grammarly.
I mean, Grammarly's been around a while, right? So it probably... Yeah, it must have existed before LLMs, and perhaps now it's using LLMs more in the background, which is why it's now so enthusiastic about rewriting what you're doing a bit more rather than just correcting things.
Yes, so Grammarly used to be a grammar correction tool, and now it's Grammarly Write with AI. So it's all about, you know, improving the tone of what you're writing, not just correcting your mistakes.
Right.
And so when I was researching this, I was like, I really don't want the rewriting bit. I just want the grammar correction. So anyway, coming back to Harper, which is what I found, it is an open source tool. It is a grammar checker, and it is just a grammar checker. It's written in Rust, because of course it is, and it runs entirely on your device. It has no cloud connections, no telemetry, no account required, and it runs in a tiny little single Go binary. And its corrections come back in milliseconds, not seconds.
Please, sir, I think you'll find it's a Rust binary, not a Go binary. Oh, just
that's my Go bias coming through there. Yes, it's a Rust bias, single Rust binary. Now, when you say Rust, you know, you think, huh, well, this can't be like Grammarly. So the good news is that it has a browser extension. Browser extensions for Firefox and Chromium and the Chromium-based browsers. And basically, it works like Grammarly. So if you ever used Grammarly and you're in the GitHub comments and you type some words and you spell the words wrong or case them incorrectly or you're missing the Oxford comma, this thing will colorize them in the appropriate way. And you click on the highlighted thing and the suggested corrections appear and you click on them.
So does the browser extension, is itself contained or does it rely on you having Harper running on that device already?
I'm not sure, because I just installed Harper and the extension, so I can't answer that. It's possible that it just runs in the browser extension, because there is a thing called Harper.js, which is from the same project and is Harper implemented in TypeScript for you to embed in TypeScript projects. So it is possible that it is all running in the browser, but I don't know for sure. What I do know is it works really, really well. It's nice and quick. It just spots the grammar mistakes. It doesn't try to rewrite anything that you're doing. So it just corrects my fumbles and mistakes, which is exactly what I started using Grammarly for all those years ago. The upside of Harper is it works literally everywhere I need it, because the one thing that Grammarly didn't do for me is it didn't integrate with any of my code editors. So one of the places where I wanted Grammarly and it just simply didn't exist was when I'm writing documentation for the projects that I maintain.
Mm-hmm.
So the good news about Harper is that it's actually implemented as a language server. And then it has some thin extensions to integrate it into Zed, VS Code, NeoVim, Emacs, Helix, and Sublime Text. So all of the places where I want to write, this thing is available.
So how does that work as a language server? Is it then a language server for English? So if you're just writing a text file, your editor will use that as the language server, or does it plug in to, you know, whatever language you're writing as well?
So it's a language server for things like markdown files, and it's email aware, and it's also a language server for code comments in a number of languages. So it kicks in when you're editing a text file that it supports, or code comment regions in a language that it knows how to process code comments for. And I've seen it do this as I've been editing things. It's pointed out grammar mistakes in my comments recently. And so I think this is fantastic. And because it's an LSP, if you want to use it in anywhere that it doesn't have like an added extension where it's got things like, you know, gutter markers and stuff like that, then it will still work as a language server anywhere that, you know, an LSP is supported.
So that means that you'd get like just like a suggestion, like you would get a code completion suggestion, it would give you a grammar completion suggestion.
Correct. Yeah.
So it looks like, having just done a bit of digging on the website and downloading it and installing the Chrome extension is Harper.js, and the downloadable CLI is like a separate thing. So you can just have the Chrome extension and then everything you do in the browser. Optionally, when I say everything in the browser, it has quite a good set of settings where you can say which like URLs, which domains you want it to work on, which ones you don't want it to work on. And you can even export out that JSON if you wanted to take that to another machine, which is quite nice.
Yeah, and I think by default it enables itself for all of the websites that they've tested it on, and you can override that and try and force enable it on something that's not been validated, or as you say, you can turn it off if you don't want it in, say, for example, Google Docs or whatever. And when it comes to extensions, it also has an extension for Obsidian and WordPress as well. So it's available in a lot of places, and I've been running it for a bit over a week now, and well, I cancelled my Grammarly subscription on day one. I installed it, I ran it for about half an hour, and I was like, right, this is it. This is exactly what I wanted. So I went into Grammarly, exported the few documents that I had in there, and terminated my plan, and that'll be the end of that. It's Harper all the way for me. Now, this is a glowing review, but there is one drawback, and that's that it's English language only. So if you are not using English language, then currently there is no support for anything other than English dialects.
Right, that was what I was going to ask. Does it support multiple dialects? I recently found that PHP Storm had started checking the grammar in my comments, but had decided there was a rule to find and remove British English. which I had to go through and disable that category.
You'll be pleased to know I've just opened the settings and there is a setting for English dialect and there are five options. Can you guess what all five of those English dialects are?
American English, British English, Australian English.
Yep.
Two more.
Canadian and New yep. Zealand.
Not Hong New Zealand. Kong? You absolutely won't get the last one. It's Indian.
Oh, okay.
That's wonderful. I love it.
And I did go looking, and amongst the community conversations, there are various people that have talked about adding, you know, Spanish and Italian and French, but nobody's actually put any wood behind that arrow yet.
As promised in the last episode, I have been continuing to play with my new Kobo reader and installing some homebrew third-party software on it. The first thing I found was called Nickel Menu. And this is basically, if you ever installed homebrew on a Wii, which I'm sure you have, Alan, you get...
I don't know what you're talking about.
There's an app called the Homebrew Channel, which is like
there is.
The thing you install, and then that lets you install and launch other things. Well, Nickel Menu is that for the Kobo. So you install this, and then it basically adds another menu to the default Kobo interface, and you can add whatever you like to that menu. And that can be... like other bits of the Kobo interface, which are either hidden or difficult to get to, buried multiple layers down, and you want to expose that. But also, you can point it at other scripts that you want it to invoke, and it'll just do that.
Remind us, the Kobo is the device you bought, you talked about in the previous episode, where you're using this as your recipe resource, or is this a different use case?
No, this is, this is the thing I'm using as my cookbook. So I've stuck a load of PDFs on it with all my recipes. I've also put some other sort of locally generated files on there, but I'm not using it to buy books through the Kobo store or listen to audiobooks or any of the other stuff that it sort of does out of the box.
I'm going to have to resist being nerd sniped here because I have a Kobo and I think you're going to tell me there's lots of cool homebrew stuff that I could be using to turn my home, my Kobo into something more interesting.
Well, listen and find out. Yeah. So Nickel Menu is your sort of your initial launcher. It's really easy to get installed. You just plug in your Kobo. There's a .kobo directory in there when it's exposed as a mass storage device, and you put in basically an image they give you called koboroot.tar.gz, and then you reboot your Kobo and it says, ah, there's a software update here, I'll install that, thank you.
Cheeky.
And you get a little update screen, and then there's your menu. It's written in Qt, which I guess that's what the whole Kobo interface must use. So it's C and C++ using Qt widgets. And the other really nice thing about it is it's got a fail-safe mechanism whereby if for some reason your Kobo can't boot, if it detects that it boots and then reboots within, I think, 20 seconds, it just deletes itself. So if it's causing any problems, it just gets out of the way and then lets it sort of reset back to normal so that you can't accidentally brick your device, which is really nice.
Wow, that is a bit of developer love right there, isn't it?
Yeah. So with this installed, I then went looking for what else I can do with it. And the thing I found, which was absolutely perfect for my use case, is called KO Reader. And this is a full custom reader interface for reading files, ebooks, PDFs, EPUBs, HTML, whatever. Not just on the Kobo, I found, which I thought was really interesting. It can also run on the Kindle and on Nooks and on other e-reader devices. So it's portable. It's written in Lua, in fact, which I thought might pique your interest, Martin.
Yeah, that's one of my favourites, Lua and Go. Yeah.
So for my use case, where all I'm doing is reading local files, this is absolutely brilliant because when you're doing what I'm doing with the Kobo interface, it's still trying to get you to go to the Kobo store and see what else is in your Kobo account. I've got some audio books which I bought previously before I moved to using Libro.fm. And so it shows me them, but I don't want that on there. I'm only reading local files. So having a reader which is just dedicated to that, it's also got lots of settings. You can fiddle with the font settings. You can fiddle with the lock screen. Lots of nice ways of configuring it. So I actually have it. So if it locks, it just stays on the current page. So if I've got it there sat in the kitchen and it goes to sleep, I don't then go, oh, now I've got to unlock it and then find the fire. It's just there. It's just turned the backlight off, which is really nice.
I was surprised that when you said it works on Kindle and other devices, I presume that requires some kind of like hacking or something I don't really care about. But I was interested to see it's also available for the Remarkable, the gigantic, very expensive, high-end thing. And there's Android devices and Linux desktop as well. There's an app image in their releases folder. It's available for loads of things.
I mean, it also has, I've not used this, but it's also got RSS sync. So if you wanted to use it as a news reader, you could add your feeds in there and have it sync your news stories down to the device. It even has an SSH server. So you can turn that on and then you've got root SSH into your Kobo. So you can use that for wirelessly transferring your files if you can't be bothered to plug it in.
It looks like an active project as well.
Yeah.
Like they've done a recent release and I mean, there's over 1,000 open issues and 65 open pull requests and 26,000 stars. It's like, I'd never heard of this.
No, nor had I.
Sounds brilliant. The bit where you said SSH, that was the point I was nerd sniped.
Yeah. So I did also go and have a look to see, you know, what else I might be able to install. And there are all sorts of other sort of gadgets and stuff. You can get various clients for wireless syncing if you want to sync from your cloud storage, which isn't one of the two that are actually supported by Kobo. So if you want to sync from Nextcloud or a few other cloud providers, there's options for that. There's a few games like chess and things like that. Yeah, the kind of games that you'd get stock on a Palm OS device, by the looks of it, that kind of thing. There's calendar apps if you want to show your Google calendars on there and stuff like that. So all sorts to keep you busy and poking around when you're not on holiday reading a book.
Well, that could be quite useful, actually, because when we go on holiday, we do sort of try and plan what we're going to do on different days. So actually putting a little calendar on the Kobo, which is the device that I use, that would be actually a useful thing to have for our holiday device.
There you go. I look forward to hearing how you get on with your hacked Kobo.
Yeah, I'm totally going to do it. I'm traveling tomorrow. I get on a plane tomorrow. I'm going to take my Kobo with me and uplift it, the experience. So this co-reader is really a way to get to sort of, in air quotes, side-loaded content that you already own that you want to read on the device.
Yes, broadly speaking, it can also sync with Calibre, the desktop app. So Calibre has a plugin specifically for Reader. Wow. Rather than for the Kobo itself. So whichever device is running it, you can use that to sync, and it'll do, like, I think it does a bit more of the metadata syncing rather than just, you know, here's a file, if you do it like that.
This sounds fabulous.
Yeah, not me just looking up Kobos on eBay right now.
Try Vinted.
I absolutely will.